This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You open the auditory door, you come in and find out what's going on in the world. Do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to anyone you can think of, really. If you enjoy this, you might enjoy other editions of the briefing room, particularly Donald Trump's end-of-year report. In this edition, I'm getting briefed on the state of the Democratic Party in the United States and looking ahead to the challenges which face them in 2018, a year of important elections. All through 2017, almost everything we in Britain have heard about the politics of our most important ally has concerned the country's oxygen-sucking president, Donald Trump. No one else gets a look in. Last week, we got briefed on what had changed during Donald Trump's first year in office. But in this last programme of 2017, we look at the opposition, the Democrats. They'll be fighting vital midterm elections for the Senate and House of Representatives in 2018. What shape are they in after a year of Trumpery? Step into the briefing room to find out.
Hillary Clinton emerging as a leading antagonist to President Donald Trump.
I'm now back to being an activist citizen and part of the resistance.
From defeat to resistance, the year for the Democrats ended with a first Senate victory in the southern state of Alabama for 25 years when Doug Jones defeated the controversial Republican candidate Roy Moore. But what was that very particular victory worth? We invited Dr. Larry Sabato into the briefing room. He's Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia, and he also produces Sabato's Crystal Ball, an online site which provides political analysis and electoral projections. Did he think the Democrats' victory in Alabama was a one-off down to the Roy Moore factor, or did it signify that something else was going on?
I think you have to be careful about analyzing Alabama or projecting your analysis on the country, because there was an extraordinarily extreme candidate running in that race, Roy Moore, the Republican nominee. He had been so far right and said so many strange and ridiculous things, as well as having had about 8 allegations of sexual harassment lodged against him, that he really is not representative of the kind of Republican nominee we'll see across the various states for Senate, governor, House in November 2018, the midterm elections. Now, having said that, certainly Alabama said something. And what it said was that the Republican Party can go too far to the right, even in a far right state like Alabama. And it is one of our four or five most conservative states. It also said that Donald Trump has lost a lot of popularity. He carried Alabama by 28 percentage points in 2016, a massive landslide. And of course, the Democrat Doug Jones won the election by about a point and a half. That's quite a switch.
What accounted for the switch? Did some people turn out more and other people turn out less?
Yes, Democrats turned out at a very high rate compared to the last couple of elections. And this has proven consistent across the United States. There have been many special congressional and state legislative elections since Trump was sworn in. And quite literally, every single election, Democratic turnout has been up relative to the Republican turnout. And Democrats have done better than they have done in the prior election or two. This is significant because if it continues, then pretty clearly there's going to be a Democratic Party wave and Democrats could be expected to do well.
Professor Larry Sabato, more from him in a few minutes. If Alabama was pretty good news for the Democrats, it came at the end of a long, horrid year for them. Many were traumatised at seeing Barack Obama hand over the nuclear codes to a property magnate come reality TV star. Since then, how has the party sought to recover? The BBC's North American editor, John Sopel, came into the briefing room to tell me about the Democrats' year.
I think the Democrats have had possibly one of their most dismal years. One, they've got the defeat of Donald Trump. And then how do you react to Donald Trump's victory? Where do you oppose him from? Do you oppose him as the traditional Democratic Party of the sort of centre, vaguely centre, maybe a bit to the left? Or do you go for the Bernie Sanders from the left? And I don't think the Democratic Party, a year on, have got many answers to these questions. In the era of the Donald Trump tweet, it is almost impossible for anyone to get their voice heard. I went to a breakfast recently with the Democratic National Chair Committee leader, Tom Perez. And the messages were, broadly, we're going to fight everywhere. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure. We're going to rebuild the organisation. We've got to be a better fighting machine. But in terms of messaging, what is their message against Donald Trump? I left that breakfast as confused as when I arrived, and I was confused all the way through the election campaign, where Donald Trump seemed to have a very clear message, Hillary Clinton, not so much.
And that's not changed?
I don't think it has changed. I think that very much the Democrats are still finding their way.
How successful have the Democrats been as, if you like, an opposition?
The Democrats have been successful-ish as an opposition. So, for example, if you look at Donald Trump's determination to repeal and replace Obamacare, that has not happened. The detailed questioning over the Russia investigation, a lot of good work is being done by Democratic senators and congressmen and women on the various committees. But in terms of setting out an agenda of what America should be, what is the direction in which America should be travelling, I still think that the Democratic Party has not picked itself up and dusted itself down after the calamitous defeat in November 2016. The people that are still garnering most attention are Joe Biden, who was the vice president, and Bernie Sanders, who ran against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic Party nomination. Yes, there are some up-and-comers. There are some people who, in a few years' time, may well be big figures on the national stage. Kamala Harris, the junior senator in California, Cory Booker in New Jersey. These are people that are seen to be up-and-coming. But in terms of front-runners, I think that it's pretty thin on the ground. The question of who sets the agenda for the Democratic Party is a brilliant question because it's almost impossible to answer. Because there is no leadership of the Democratic Party. If you look to Britain, you can say, well, Jeremy Corbyn is the leader of the Labour Party, and therefore his writ will start to run through and he will be setting the agenda of where he wants to take the party. You know what the leadership structure is. In the US, you don't have that system. There are senators who look at themselves each morning in the mirror and say, yeah, I could be president. And there are congressmen and women who are doing the same. You've also got now a lot of mayors in their own cities who are doing very effective work. And maybe they're going to be the next people on the international stage or the national stage. Mitch Landrieu in New Orleans is seen as doing a very, very good job. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, again, doing a very good job. But they're kind of known in LA. They're known in New Orleans. They're not known in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, all those states which are so key to winning a presidential election. I think the Donald Trump election victory changed the way people think about who can become president. Until Donald Trump, it had either been someone who had held high elected office, a senator, a congressman, a governor, or it had been someone who had been senior in the armed services, Eisenhower, for example. Donald Trump has changed all that. I wouldn't be surprised if you start looking at the George Clooneys. Is it going to be someone from Facebook or someone from Google? The mold has been broken. It may not be put back together. So let's stop thinking in conventional terms about who is the next presidential candidate.
So if I force you to choose between Oprah Winfrey and Kim Kardashian, which side are you going to come down, John?
Oprah, just. I think Oprah Winfrey is a very serious possibility. There are all sorts of names. The net is being cast ever wider because they've seen what happened in 2016, and suddenly people think that in US politics, anything, everything is possible.
John Sopel. Next year's congressional midterm elections will be the first nationwide poll on Donald Trump's presidency since his victory in 2016. So what sort of a challenge do they represent for the Democrats? Let's hear more from Dr. Larry Sabato.
Generally speaking, with only a few exceptions in modern American history, the incumbent White House party, in this case the Republicans under Donald Trump, have not done well in midterms. And one would expect Trump's party, the GOP, to do poorly in November in any event. If I had to guess today, I would guess 2018 is going to be a crash and burn election. All 435 U.S. House seats are on the ballot. One-third of the 100 seats in the U.S. Senate will be on the ballot. And you will also have 36 of the 50 states electing governors and state legislators. There are thousands of state legislative positions. So it really is quite a good barometer of where people stand politically at that moment.
Are you saying that the Republicans could actually lose control of the House and/or the Senate?
I think they have a good chance to lose control of the House of Representatives, which is really quite amazing because the Republicans controlling a very large majority of the states, thanks to their gains under President Obama, it's really going to take quite a wave to switch the 24 net seats necessary for Democrats to gain control. But right now, it looks very doable. Now, with the loss of the Alabama seat, Republicans now control the Senate only 51-49. And with Trump's, frankly, massive unpopularity, which extends to some red states, it's difficult to see the Republicans gaining seats. They may gain a seat or two, but there is an outside chance a year in advance that Democrats could manage to find the two net seats they need to take control of the Senate. It's possible.
Now, this suggests that you believe that the Democratic electoral machine is actually in good fighting order, despite the fact that there seems to be, on the face of it, a division between their more left-wing personality and their more centrist personality.
I wouldn't say the Democratic machine is in good order. I would say that Democratic activists are energized and enthused and strongly opposed to Trump, and they are giving record amounts of money. They are campaigning for candidates many, many hours more than they campaigned for Hillary Clinton, for example. It makes a difference. It increases your party turnout, And of course, many Republicans are disillusioned by what has happened during the Trump year so far. So you put all that together, you can produce a Democratic victory in an off year. But that does not say anything about what's going to happen in 2020.
Well, let's talk about that precise thing. Does the nature of the electoral college system in the states, because some states have a lot more electoral votes than others, does that mean that the Democrats can afford to concentrate on the bigger states with the most electoral votes in order to win?
Democrats have a real problem in the electoral college because Republicans, particularly Trump because of his blue-collar appeal, can now win by narrow margins just enough states to get in the White House and yet lose the popular vote. Democrats have to turn those states around. They're going to have to find a nominee who can actually win blue-collar votes, who doesn't turn people off. It's not enough to win California by 62% of the vote, which is what Clinton did. She won California by 4 million popular votes. In our system, which is antiquated and should have been abolished a long time ago, you can win a state by one single vote.
If you had to nominate some possible Democrat candidates for presidency in 2020, who might you go for at this stage?
There are at least six major Democratic potential nominees who are seriously considering running, who are in their 70s or over 80. Look, I'm 65. I have nothing against senior citizens. I'm not an ageist. However, I think it's time to close down the nursing home for the Democratic Party. Elizabeth Warren, Senator from Massachusetts, is too old. Joe Biden is too old. Governor Jerry Brown of California is too old. Bernie Sanders will be around 80. He's too old. They need to remember how Democrats win. Look at the Democrats who have won since 1950. John F. Kennedy, young in his early 40s, the next Democrat to win without succeeding to the presidency. Jimmy Carter, in his 40s, young and vigorous. The next Democrat to win, Bill Clinton, in his 40s, young and vigorous. The next Democrat to win, Barack Obama, in his 40s, young and vigorous. Do you get the picture? Maybe they should nominate somebody in his 40s or her 40s, early 50s, who's young and vigorous. That would be my suggestion, but what do I know?
Dr. Larry Sabato. And slap in the middle of his analysis was the problem of that necessary part of any winning Democrat coalition, the white blue-collar worker. This is the group studied by Joan C. Williams, a professor of law at Hastings College, which is part of the University of California. She's written a book called The White Working Class. When she joined me in the briefing room, I asked her to explain who she was really talking about.
The bottom roughly 30% of American households are poor, and the top roughly 17 to 20% are what I call the professional managerial elite. The people commonly being called the white working class are actually the middle class, the people in the middle 53% of Americans. And these Americans have seen their economic fortunes just plummet. So, for example, almost every American born in the 1940s did better than their parents economically, but today it's less than half. So these people in these rural areas or Rust Belt, former, you know, industrial areas, have seen the American dream just slipping from their grasp. And either it's happened, in which case they're extremely angry, as one South Carolina Trump voter said, "We voted with our middle finger." Or it hasn't happened yet, but they're extraordinarily worried about it. And those people also voted for Trump. And one of the most dramatic things is that even union members voted for Trump.
Why is that?
Well, you know, the Republicans, I have great admiration for their political savvy. They have offered a perfect explanation of the economic plight of this middle class. Why have good jobs left your area? It's because of trade treaties. So we're against trade treaties. Why have the ones that came in to replace them been very low-paid, dead-end jobs? It's because immigrants are driving wages down. How can we solve this problem? Create a tax cut that's going to create a huge boom for American business. It's going to create good new jobs everywhere that are well-paid like the old days. So the Republicans are listening to the economic pain of this group. Meanwhile, the Democrats have not placed at the center of their agenda good jobs for people without college degrees. Two-thirds of Americans have not graduated from college. When I started talking about social class in America, people did not believe it. And so they were focused on immigration. They're focused on LGBTQ rights, environmental issues. Meanwhile, Republicans were talking about the economic issues in a way that was very cogent, persuasive, I happen to believe completely false. Hillary Clinton talked about jobs. It was like, you know, number 432 of her 698 cherished, detailed policy prescriptions.
Why is it, in that case, given presumably that, say, Latinos or black people suffer from the same problems, that they don't therefore respond in the same way?
When it's hard to drive without getting arrested and you're worried about whether your sons are going to be shot in the streets, you tend to focus on police misconduct. And those are pretty pressing issues in the United States for many, many African Americans. You know, you're not going to be able to make progress on those issues unless you can bring together communities of color with these white communities. And communities of color care about having good jobs for people without college degrees. That's incredibly important to them. And so what I've been trying to say to the Democratic Party is, I share all of those other values, but if you care about climate change, you'd better care about the economic fortunes of the white working class.
You seem to point at something which can't easily be reconciled. If, let's say, for black people, the problem of having their kids shot, as you very clearly put it, is going to be paramount, how can they agree that the main issue should, in fact, be jobs?
You know, I don't think it's a zero-sum game. You never have a party standing for one issue. But, I mean, Steve Bannon, who is now back as head of Breitbart News, which is an extremely far-right conservative news organization, Steve Bannon, after Charlottesville, said in public, so long as we can keep them talking about race, we've got them. And my attitude is, if you actually care about all of that panoply of progressive issues, you got to care about the economic fortunes of Americans without college grads, because if you don't, you're playing right into the hands of the likes of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump.
So it's your contention that if, let's say, the Democrats said jobs is our number one, there isn't going to be anything, and then we're going to have the others at number two, three, four, and five, that this section of what we've called the white working class that has voted for Trump will turn around and say, yeah, well, we'll buy two, three, four, and five if we have to, as long as we get one.
You know, as I say, I don't think it has to be a zero-sum game. I do think the way you construct a coalition politically is you give each segment of the coalition something that matters to them very, very deeply. And I think in recent times, the Democrats have really been narrowcasting of like, okay, this is for the LGBTQ community, this is for women, this is for X, Y, Z, and they haven't given anything of value to the white working class at the same time as the college-educated elite, which dominates the Democratic Party, has often spoken very disrespectfully of white working class workers. We have cultural stereotypes in popular programs that your audience wouldn't recognize, but like All in the Family, Homer Simpson.
Our audience will recognize Homer Simpson.
Okay, if you recognize Homer Simpson, Homer Simpson is a blue-collar guy who is bumbling, clumsy, stupid, probably fat. That's a class-based stereotype which has been purveyed absolutely unselfconsciously in the United States for the past 40 years. And if we wonder why people are offended, it's because we have been insulting them. That is a stereotype that is very inconsistent with modern ideals of equality. But the fact that we have been so blind to the kind of cheerful purveying of such stereotypes has been part, not all, but part of what has really deeply poisoned the politics of the United States.
There is the kind of sense that in some way or other, caring about, let's say, women's rights or abortion rights, or even putting forward a white woman president, is in and of itself a provocation to the group of people that you're talking about.
I think caring about women, people of color, LGBTQ, caring about all of those groups and insulting and stereotyping the white working class pretty much guarantees that the white working class will direct huge anger against women, people of color, and immigrants, and LGBTQ. That's a guarantee. So we actually don't know what would happen if college-educated elites stopped talking insultingly about the white working class and started to listen respectfully to what they care about.
What else would you actually do if you were a Democrat, a Democrat strategist?
What we need in the United States is a few different things. Number one, we need to recognize that trade treaties hurt some people and have hurt areas of the country. And Democrats need to say loud and clear that they hear that. And by the way, Democrats in Congress have always believed that. Number two, we need to talk about how, you know, we did globalization wrong as a country and we're paying the price now. We need to do automation right, because there's going to be huge dislocations related to automation. And what we need to do is to develop a new education to employment system that gives non-college grads the skills they need to interact with robots in a way that's going to mean that they are giving enough value add to create a truly middle-class job.
I know this sounds kind of crude, but if you were thinking of a kind of candidate for the Democrats at the next presidential election, or the type of candidate Democrats should put up, you've been quoted as saying that you don't think that it would be sensible for the Democrats, say, to put up a white woman candidate because the electorate that you need to appeal to, that bit of the electorate, won't like it.
I said that very shortly after the election. I was a pretty upset little girl. And I do think it's a little more complicated than I was making it. One thing that is very true is that when you have men, you know, everybody's touchy about their dignity. Men are more touchy about their dignity than women. And blue-collar men are more touchy about their dignity than other men. So the idea that my father could support his family with one job and now I can't, and all I can get is a muck job, we call them. When you have that sort of ocean of hurt male dignity, you know, a woman candidate is going to have to overcome that. One thing is very clear, regardless of kind of the body shape of the candidate, is that if Democrats don't run someone who can connect with the so-called white working class in Rust Belt areas, they just don't want to win.
I'm wondering what kind of candidate that is.
People ask me whom I support for president, and I have a very clear answer. I support a Democrat who could win.
So is it your impression that Donald Trump could actually win again and that Democrats understand this?
I think there's a very robust chance. Unless something changes, he's going to be reelected.
Well, given that they might perceive that as well, do you think Democrats are listening to the kind of things that people like you are saying?
I do think they're listening. I think that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and that's my wing, those are my people, I think there's also a different story being told, and it's a competing story, which is that all we need to do is to get out our votes in what's called the rising Democratic electorate of people of color, single moms, women. And if we get out our vote, we don't need to worry about the white working class. So there's two competing stories, and I don't think we should be competing. But I think with our political structure, the structure of the Electoral College, the structure of the Senate, the importance of the state legislatures, I think it's political suicide to ignore the white working class, and it's political suicide in a country that's predominantly white, and it's also unethical and unbecoming of us as Democrats.
Joan C. Williams on the political and moral need for connection with the white working class. And earlier we heard Larry Sabato on how the experience of Trump is galvanising Democrat voters. And clearly this is all part of a conversation being had across America in Democratic Party circles. My thanks to Joan C. Williams, Larry Sabato and our own John Sopel. Until next Thursday, in the meantime, a Happy New Year. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Jim Frank. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: Startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.